Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, the first at the dawn of this new decade, we'll be looking ahead to 2020 to find out what's popping.
We'll meet Jacques Testard, founder of the iconic publishing house Fitzcarraldo Edition.
Sit down with Claire Goff, director of West London's Pitshanger Manor and Gallery.
And catch up with Chris Vaughan, director of experimental music festival Mode Exchange.
That's all coming up. Plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news. And we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Kaboom! And in a sort of puff of smoke, here we are. We've arrived in 2020, almost surviving the Christmas holidays. Or Happy New Year to you.
Right back at you, Rob. What did you do?
Well, it was kind of countrified. It was kind of busy. Country Christmas, Sussex. Friends over from Greece, staying in the house, making the house feel quite small. Boom! Norfolk for New Year's Eve with
nice.
some members of staff that some of our listeners may know, once of this parish. Fun and games, barely recovered. Here we are sitting in the studio, a little bit of sweat upon the brow. How was your news, your Christmas and New Year's?
Lovely, lovely. It was lovely. I went back to Cambridge. I had a nice time there. Went to Paris, almost directly from Cambridge.
Beautiful.
Difficult because of the protests.
Is that a direct train?
Almost, actually.
They just put you in a giant catapult.
Yeah. Trebuchet, technically.
Okay, yeah.
So I landed there, which was good because the Eurostar had been shut down, so yeah. It was better to be flung. And then, yeah, had a lovely time in a raving in the banlieue in a gay club.
Great. Amazing
stuff. Yeah,
I love
really
it.
Nice.
Okay.
Really, really nice.
You still got a little bit of glitter on your face.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be keeping that for the next couple of weeks.
Okay. Like the old Glastonbury wristband.
Yeah. What do you think of the chaps, by the way?
I think they're pretty good. I want to get the lowdown on them.
I think before we run ahead of ourselves, there's so much to get through. No one has made enough of a deal about the fact that this is the start of a new decade.
I know.
You know, the roaring 20s, man.
I know. I don't know how to process it, other than perhaps behaving like someone from the 1920s. I feel like crashing a Bugatti.
Nice.
Maybe I've already done it in radio terms, but we'll see how the rest of the show goes on.
Let's see what's happening in our immediate future, shall we? With none other than Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Straight off the plane from Brazil. Here he is.
Exciting to be back. Well, I miss my country, actually, guys. Can I be honest here?
Yeah, it's all right. We all feel a little bit rusty on our first radio program of the new decade, don't we?
But it's good to see friendly faces. And I have to say, cool, it's one of the first weeks of the year, but there's a lot of exciting things happening. Especially today, it's the Golden Globes.
Oh, wow, it is.
I think I mentioned to you guys, of course, I love the Oscars. I'm not one of those that criticize the Oscars all the time. But they could learn a few things with the Golden Globes, especially if you're watching at home. It's fun. You see celebrities drinking champagne, you know. I think, you know, it's
set
more
out
like
around dinner tables. It's
exactly.
Not the old. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, I haven't seen all the nominees yet, but perhaps could be a good night for The Irishman, or even one of my favorites, which is Parasite. I think it's excellent film. And he deserves, you know, all the attention it's getting. Even one that we were discussing here before, Knives Out. I think, you know, that
Is that up for anything? I mean, it's really. I mean, I'd imagine the synopsis. I mean, I love the story. I think the script's knife sharp. No pun intended. I also think it's probably one of those things that's up for all the technical awards because it's a tough thing to put together, editing, grading, all that stuff. It's a very striking film to behold, isn't it?
And this is the kind of film that gives me hope that Hollywood can still release kind of a, you know, just a film for adults that is just not a blockbuster. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
actually, nice.
And it's doing well. The public ones, I mean, we shouldn't underestimate the public. It's doing quite well in the box office. So I think we should blame sometimes the studios. They have to be a bit more brave. We need something between as well, not just the blockbuster or the super little art house.
We need
Knives Out.
And I've heard from you both that the Oscars might learn something, not just from the Golden Globes pageantry, but also from the breadth of its genre recognition, that it celebrates films from across, you know, blockbuster, art house, comedy, musical, whatever.
Well, I look forward to see the nominations. They're coming out on Monday, the 13th. So,
by the way, who is presenting the Golden Globes?
It's Ricky Gervais for the last time, apparently.
Oh, he's doing it because he's taken a rest. He's come back.
Yeah, and the times that he presented, it was quite funny because he was quite acid with some of his jokes. And it's interesting because now, especially in the Me Too era, I wonder how acid will he allow to be. So it'll be interesting to see.
Of potentially even more comedy.
Yeah,
at the brave comedian's disposal. My favourite of his introductory notes was when he was I won't spoil it, but he's like, and here he is, the only person that Ben Affleck's ever been faithful to, it's Matt Damon. I think Ben Affleck was sitting in the audience, and so was his wife. So
very nice.
Went down particularly well.
Faye, where are we going next?
Well, the next story is not a very nice one.
Okay.
But, you know, I hate those
serious faces now, Rob.
Okay.
Well, not that serious in a way.
I'm still thinking about the only person that Ben Affleck's been faithful to.
But apparently, I disagree with that, but apparently Monday, the 6th of January, is the most depressing day of the year. And, you know, I can understand why some people, especially here in the Northern Hemisphere, they find January, you know, so dreadful. I have a tip. Maybe we should stop with this dry January or dry everything. Okay, if you want to do dry March, you know, but don't start the year cutting things out of your life.
Yeah, it's tough.
So my tip is, you know, drink, gamble, have sex, you know, do wonderful things. And cut then maybe March if you really feel like to.
So let's move away from this boring frugality.
Well, and this is definitely not frugal. On Saturday, it's the beginning of the men's fashion weeks. And the first one, it's Milano. I mean, look, I'll just give you some of the brands that were there. Brunello Cucinelli, Prada, Giorgio Armani, Fendi. So all the big ones. I think Milan does very well menswear still. You know, I think if you're interested in that, you should definitely be checking out, I mean, the catwalks. And Prada, we should always look at Prada because I think they're still very influential. I wouldn't say it's my favorite kind of collections usually, but, you know, I think it's what you see at Prada, you will end up seeing other brands some way or another.
And does the men's fashion weeks follow the kind of tablature written down by the ladies' fashion weeks? That Paris is high fashion, Milan does a lot of business, New York is where the advertisers come, London's for the kind of like next breakout stars, the kind of the fashion crazies. Is it like that with the men's?
It is actually in a way. And of course, everything's changing. You know, some brands, they're deciding to do a man and women together in a way. I actually quite like to see them separate in a way because otherwise it looks like too much cost cutting. A good start for the year. Golden Globes, fashion.
It's amazing.
And no dry anything.
You knocked it out of the park, I remember, Faye, on your final news look ahead of the last decade. You have entered the new decade in incredible form, don't you think, Org?
Absolutely,
I do. I'm fascinated by all those topics.
I look forward to a year of these. Very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Fernando. You're listening to the first Monocle Weekly of the new year. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Fitzcarraldo Editions founder Jacques Testard.
London publishing house Fitzcarraldo Editions celebrated its fifth birthday last summer. What a fifth birthday year it was. In the autumn, one of its writers, the Polish author Olga Tokarczuk, was announced as a winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Tokarczuk is one of the many fantastic authors Fitzcarraldo publishes in translation. It also does English language fiction and, alongside that, essays too. The fiction is bound in bold blue jackets with white typeface and the essays white jacketed with blue type. They're instantly recognisable and kind of compulsive, I think. Everyone ends up with shelves full.
Yeah, they're kind of a collector's dream, these books.
Big time. It's been a great half decade for Fitzcarraldo, clearly, so I sat down with founder Jacques Testard for a debrief and a look ahead to next year. What would you say, you know, Fitzcarraldo Editions has celebrated its fifth birthday this year, 2019. What would you kind of describe broadly as its remit?
That's a very broad question.
It is very broad.
I would say I set it up on my own 5 years ago now, to publish ambitious, innovative, contemporary writing, to take risks on books that others might not want to publish, that might be perceived to be too difficult for the mainstream, for more commercial publishers. And I think to publish the kind of books that I enjoy reading and that weren't necessarily being published.
Yeah, I get this feeling when I look at, when I read any of your books, this sense that, you know, I have a friend who defined good music, interesting music, as something which sounds like the musician is pushing him or herself to do something new. And that's the feeling that I get from the authors that you publish. How do you kind of engage with that? How do you make sure that that's always what you're turning out?
We publish quite a wide variety of books. Mm. So half of our program is translation. We have become perhaps more successful for the translation because two of our authors have won the Nobel Prize in the last 5 years, Olga Tokarczuk and Svetlana Alexievich. So for those authors, I've been lucky enough to arrive at a time when the bigger publishing houses are kind of shying away from the literary fiction that's being published in Europe. So I've been able to pick up world-class authors and start publishing them. On the English language side, it's slightly different because we are a small press, so we don't have huge amounts of money to spend on advances. So we have to be a bit more creative in the way that we find our authors. Quite a few of the debut authors we've published, and out of the 54 books published so far, 8 have been English language debuts, have come from authors who I first published in The White Review, the magazine I set up with my friend Ben Eastham 10 years ago now. As for how you make sure you're keeping on publishing, cutting-edge writing or whatever, I think as I've kind of gone on doing this, I've realised it's become clearer what a Fitzcarraldo book is and even clearer what a Fitzcarraldo book isn't. And I have this vague idea, that I think Roberto Colasso, the Italian publisher and writer, has expressed much more eloquently than me, that a publishing house's catalogue is akin to a greater work of art, I guess. And each book is a kind of single link in a chain that makes up this kind of bigger, you know, bigger work of art that has connections, well, the books have connections with each other, or, you know, the catalogue is constellation kind of thing. So I guess when we read stuff, and it's not just me acquiring stuff anymore, my colleague Tamara does too, connections with other books, you know, finding books that are in conversation with the things we're publishing already is part of the way, I guess, we try and maintain the, you know, the quality.
Mm. I think that idea of a catalogue as a constellation is really fascinating, and it seems like something that maybe can only really meaningfully be done at a certain scale. Do you have a sense that, like, the size of Fitzcarraldo facilitates this kind of publishing policy?
I don't have enough experience to answer that question because I've only been doing this for 5 and a bit years. I think staying small enables you to publish the books you want to. I mean, there's one kind of famous example, New Directions in America, a publishing house set up by a man called James Laughlin in 1936. There's a rumour that in his will he said New Directions could never employ a 13th person because he thought the 13th employee would mean that they'd have to start doing cookbooks or whatever. It turns out this isn't actually true, but they've kept the company that size. They've never employed that 13th person, and they only publish literary books. So I think there's a certain amount of freedom that comes with being smaller, but then we've also tripled in size since I started. You know, the first year it was just me doing 6 books. Next year we'll do 15, and there are 4 of us, 2 full-time, 2 part-time. So we haven't changed the remit, and I have no plans to, but yeah, time will tell.
You mentioned that translation sort of makes up a big part of what you publish. And, you know, I've been thinking that in the last couple of years, it seems like people have woken up to the literary sort of significance of translation in a way that maybe they weren't aware of before, this idea that you're just kind of taking a language and turning it into another has sort of given way to this awareness of the art of it, I suppose. And people like Emily Wilson and Yasmin Seal have played a part in that, in translating classics. Have you sort of, with any gratification, observed this shift towards an awareness of the value of translation and thought about the role that Fitzcarraldo has played in that?
Yeah, I'd say there's more interest in translation and the practice of it. We published a book by Kate Briggs called This Little Art, which is a book I'm very, very fond of and which I think of as foundational in a way to what we do at Fitzcarraldo. It's a book both about the practice of translation, how we do it, and also an attempt to write an essay with the kind of narrative propulsion of a novel. So it tells several stories about Thomas Mann and his translator, about André Gide and his English translator, Dorothy Bussy. But no, in terms of translation as a whole, I think we still have a lot of work to do. I think there was an article earlier this year about how 5 or 6% now of books sold in the UK are translation. Half of those are Ferrante and Knausgård, which is great, and they've played a part in, you know, making people who would never pick up a translation buy translations and read them. But in France, I think 26% or something of all books published every year are translations, and that stat holds up across, you know, most of Western Europe. So we're really far behind in this country in terms, and America's even worse than the UK in terms of publishing translation. But I think it is a good time to be a small press doing translation. I also think there are some very interesting and exciting new prizes, like the Warwick Prize for Women in Translation, which is growing and becoming more important every year, and which we were fortunate enough to win this year for Annie Ernaux's The Years, translated by Alison Strayer. The International Booker Prize obviously has become very important and has a significant sales impact. And I think, yeah, by and large, there's a community of people interested in translation, not just translators, but publishers, readers, critics, etc., that's kind of growing. And that's been, yeah, fun to be a part of.
As an aside, do you think that substantially higher percentage of books sold in France in translation, is that a mindset thing? Is that because in France people don't distinct that a book is a book? They don't even think about the kind of fact of it having been translated from another country? Or is that part of what has to change?
Yeah, I think so. I'm French originally. I grew up reading lots of books in French. When you walk into a bookshop in France, Balzac will be next to Bolaño, and, you know, Sebald will be next to Gertrude Stein and Stendhal. And here there's usually a translated literature section. But I also think it's a lot to do with the insularity of and the kind of monoglot Anglophone culture. This idea that all the great work is produced in English, therefore we don't need to, you know, look elsewhere. I mean, also, you know, British publishing is inherently conservative, has always been pretty conservative. There are very few editors who translate, who acquire translations in British publishing who speak another language. Whereas if you look at, you know, publishing houses in Germany, for example, Zurkamp, to work in the translated literature department there, if you don't speak at least three languages, you have no chance. So yeah, I think it's a cultural thing, but kind of across the board.
To look ahead to, well, this year, 2020, which, as we were discussing in the office earlier, is the first year of a new decade, but no one seems to be that fussed by that kind of...
Everyone's too depressed.
You've had this really outward-looking catalogue of publications in the past. They've just a couple. You've published books about Russia, about the Philippines. It seems like in the context of Brexit and of the kind of real consolidation of the island mentality, publishing books like this is kind of increasingly political. Is that something that you're keen to really push forward on?
I think publishing's always been political, to be honest. It's like news media or whatever. It's part of the way in which we keep the people in power in check, although obviously on quite a small scale for the kind of publishing that we do. I've been having, you know, recently conversations after the last general election about the role of the publisher once again in a different cultural climate, conversations we've been having repeatedly for the last 4 years, well, 3 years since the Brexit referendum. After the Brexit referendum, I decided we should publish a Polish author because of the violence against Polish migrants in the UK, etc., and that's how I first read Olga Tokarczuk. This time, I'm not sure what the answer is going to be, but we do have some pretty political books coming up, not least in January, Paul Preciado's book coming out on the 20th, An Apartment on Uranus, which is a book about gender transitioning. And it's collected short pieces, basically, covering 4 years during which Paul transitioned from female to male. But it's also an account of, I guess, the migrant crisis. It's got a memoir element to it as well, and really puts forward a very radical argument for a new gender politics beyond trans issues, etc. And it's really a very unusual and unique book, so we're very excited about that. Paul will be coming to London in February to do an event at the ICA with Jack Halberstam, and we're going to go to Nottingham and Liverpool as well. We've also got our first Palestinian novel coming up in May 2020, a writer called Adania Shibley. It's a very short novel, which she took 10 years to write. It's a novel in two parts. The first half is the story of a Palestinian woman who is raped and murdered in the Negev Desert by Israeli soldiers in 1949. And in the second half of the novel, a woman reads about this rape and murder in present-day Ramallah and becomes obsessed by this minor detail of history as it's described in the article, and decides to leave her home in Ramallah to try and find out more. And so it's a novel partly about the experience of life under occupation, but importantly for, you know, for us and for the Fitzcarraldo List, it's a novel that's as good and stands up to, you know, the work of Matthias Inar and Annie Ernaux, etc. So Adani is, I think, one of the leading writers in Arabic, and, you know, we're very excited to be beginning to publish her. It'll be interesting to see how the book is received. I found out quite recently, I was in Palestine in April for the first time for PalFest, and found out that the New York Times, for example, has never reviewed a novel by a Palestinian writer, male or female, ever. And there have been, you know, there have been a few. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the media and critics kind of respond to the novel.
That's fascinating. And as you said, you have this event that you'll be taking around in January. Is that an area that you're kind of developing? Is that something that works in terms of generating a bit of engagement with audiences and also kind of boosting the profile of the authors that you work with?
We've always done a lot of events. Mm. I think we do more events than most presses. I guess the general our policy is if the author's up for doing something, we'll organise as much or as little as they want to do. I think it helps raise the profile of the press as well. You know, we're 5 years in, but I don't think everyone in Britain has or knows who we are. So any event anywhere we do, even if we don't sell an author's book that night, because of all our books look the same, blue and white, they'll forever be aware of them after that. But no, more kind of broadly speaking, events are really important. And I think we've managed to create a community of loyal readers and people who come to our events because they're interesting, because sometimes they're quite fun, and people who really follow what we publish as a press rather than individual authors. And, you know, we have subscribers, people walk into bookshops and ask for the new Fitzcarraldo and buy it not knowing what it is. So I guess, yeah, I think we've come to be known as something like a record label. You know, you follow the press. There are obviously authors who are bigger than the press and who will reach wider audiences, but we can also count on this kind of smaller, loyal readership.
Fantastic. So what else? You've mentioned too, what else is on the horizon?
There's a novel coming out in February, which I'm very excited about, which is written by Mexican writer Fernanda Melchor. The book is called Hurricane Season, translated by Sophie Hughes. It's a novel that opens with the murder of a local witch in a small town near Veracruz. And we then go back in time, and through a series of six monologues by different unreliable narrators, we get an overview of what happens in the run-up to this murder. It's an incredibly violent and profane and superstitious novel. I guess you could describe it as something like a conflation of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Macondo and Roberto Bolaño's Ciudad Juarez. It's about the loss of innocence and tradition, and I guess the endemic violence that's gripped Mexico today. It's also one of those rare books that's formally experimental, hugely ambitious in what she's trying to do with the structure of the novel, and also compulsively readable. And the hurricane from the title really refers actually to the monologues, because the six monologues, you just get sucked in, and this is kind of whirlwind of language. And my mum read it. I was worried that she would find it too brutal and you know, too tough to read, and she read it in two sittings and loved it. So I think it could appeal widely. And Fernanda's absolutely brilliant. So we're excited to bring her over in May as well.
Fantastic. Sounds great. And hopefully she will come and join us on the Monocle Weekly.
That would be wonderful.
Jacques, thank you so much. And here's to five more years. And
thanks for having me.
Great 2020. Thanks to Jacques Testard. And do keep an eye on Fitzcarraldo Editions' website, fitzcarraldoeditions.com, for news of events and new releases in 2020. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Time for some fab music now. Here's an artist we're excited to follow this year. We'll hopefully speak to soon. Her new album is out later this month. But let's listen to a triumph from last year. This is OK Kaya with her cover of Cher's Believe.
Do you believe in life after love? I can feel something inside me say, I really don't think you're strong enough, no. No.
That was Believe by OK Kaya. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. The Pitshanger Manor and Gallery in West London reopened last March after a three-year refurbishment project. Once the home of notable British architect Sir John Soane, the building was restored to its original Regency glory. The attached gallery, meanwhile, was improved and expanded, opening with an exhibition by Anish Kapoor.
with an exciting programme lined up for this year, all caught up with the Manor and Galleries director, Claire Gough, to learn more.
So Pitt Sanger is Sir John Soane the architect's country house. It was built by John Soane in 1800 in what was then the country, in the village of Ealing, now of course caught up by expanding Victorian London. But in those days he wanted to have a country house to show off to his clients what he could do for them. So it needed to be in the country but close to London so that they could come out and visit very easily. It is his beautiful Regency country villa that we've just restored just this year, just reopened this year in March, well, last year. And adjacent to it, we've created a contemporary art gallery where we put on really exciting exhibitions that are intended to relate in some way to Soane's architecture next door, to set up a sort of dialogue between them so that any visitor will look at the Regency House in a new light after they've seen the exhibition.
So this follows a three-year refurbishment,
yes.
Is that right? What was going on with the manor before that?
Yeah, the manor had been lived in by a whole succession of private families after John Soane's time until 1900. And then in 1900, it was sold to the local council, to Ealing Council. And what do you do with a house like that when you get it? Well, you make it into a library. So they made the house into a library and they made his gorgeous parkland outside into a public park, now called Walpole Park. But of course, over the years, John Soane's designs had been altered and adapted and extended. So it became, there were extensions built to the house, and unbelievably, in the 1830s, the owners had whitewashed the entire inside. So John Soane's incredible interior decorative schemes were completely covered over. The consequence of these extensions, this painting and so on, made it very difficult to read the incredible John Soane designs in the building. So that three-year process of conservation has been a sort of labour of love to take it back to how it was in John Soane's time. And it has been so gorgeous, slowly, to see the layers peel back and to see this gem of a building sort of re-emerge. And so that's just been an absolute joy.
That's really exciting. I mean, obviously, you know, with these kind of heritage projects, there's occasionally a bit of debate around them. I think of, like, the piers that get restored, and it's sort of, to what end?
Yeah.
When we talk about heritage, we think of this thing that's been put back.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting indeed to hear that it's been put back next to a gallery that's working in the contemporary sphere. Was that always going to be a part of the project?
No, that's so interesting, because Soane himself was an incredibly eclectic collector. So he had in his house a range of things from antiquities, from ancient Greece and ancient Rome, right up to what was then contemporary art. When we were working out what was the right thing to do with this, we felt that it was great to carry on that legacy and really to do in the adjacent space, do exhibitions really that we sort of thought that Soane himself would have approved of had he been doing them today. And so the idea of having contemporary art feels so fitting with Soane. Soane really wanted, had a real vision for inspiring the next generation of architects and designers, and we have picked that up as our vision, is to take that forwards, and with our contemporary art and exhibitions is to inspire the next generation of artists and designers.
Obviously, the Sir John Soane's Museum is in Lincoln's Inn Fields in Holborn, which isn't too far from our HQ here at Midori House. He used to walk.
He used to walk between them.
Is that removed? Is that a separate thing, or is there a kind of exchange between you and the museum?
It's a separate organisation, but we've got really good relations, and we're working very hard on developing all sorts of partnerships. They have been incredibly helpful because they own the archive of all of Soane's drawings and plans. So the amazing thing on embarking on this conservation was that we had Soane's original plans, but also a lot of watercolours that he had commissioned of the building. So that was an enormous help. And the team there, the archivists there, have been fantastic in terms of giving us support while we've been trying to work out exactly what Soane had. And we're very excited about ongoing collaborations. So one of our projects for this coming year is we've got an amazing exhibition opening in March, which will be based around a set of paintings that Soane bought for Pitt Sanger, Hogarth's A Rake's Progress, which he bought for Pitt Sanger, but now sit in his old London home. And so the Soane Museum are lending them back to us. So they will be shown in Pitt Sanger for the first time in over 200 years.
That's great. What's really exciting to hear is that kind of process of, you know, almost detective work, going to the John Soane's Museum, looking at his old watercolours, bringing them back to kind of use those as a basis to work on the house, to restore it, the manor, I should say. Having restored it, you opened with an exhibition of Anish Kapoor's work.
We did.
You've also had this year Ez Devlin.
Yes.
These are two artists who are kind of monumental, right? They make these big installations. They kind of work with the space as its own medium of form in the space. In 2020, is it going to be more of the same? Have you set the tone with these guys?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's our intention. So we want to, in our exhibitions, we want to pick up on those sort of three passions of Soane's, which is art, architecture and design, and make sure that each of our exhibitions is really following in that field. So no, we've got a really exciting programme. The Hogarth exhibition will be of the Hogarth Rakes Progress, but with contemporary art around it. Some really exciting contemporary artists picking up on some of the themes that we think Hogarth might have picked up on, issues of living in London today that Hogarth might have commented on if he was painting the Rakes Progress today. But absolutely following up with having some really exciting both artists, contemporary artists, but also designers and architects having exhibitions there.
Curatorially, who have you got working on it?
So we've got an amazing curator called John Leslie.
Yeah.
Who
Not
has
that
been...
John Leslie.
And he has pulled together this fantastic group of very diverse artists who will be picking up on lots of very different themes. There's so many subjects that we could have followed for the Hogarth, but some really interesting artists who'll be doing, and some new commissions for it as well.
Alongside the gallery space, obviously you have the manor. Presumably it isn't just a place for people to go and look around and see how amazing the Regency kind of architecture was. What else are you using it for?
We really want to animate the manor and the gallery space. And to do that, we've got a whole succession of events trying to find something that will make something for everybody. So ranging from artist talks, we had an amazing talk with Anish Kapoor when he came back to talk about his art and his whole body of work, through to art classes. We've been doing some life classes, through to little builders for under five. So a whole range of things. We're developing a wonderful series of activities for people suffering from dementia. So a whole range of things to make sure we're doing something to engage the local community.
That sounds fantastic. I mean, you're square in Ealing, which is one of the bigger boroughs. There's a huge, enormous range of people in there. How are you working to engage with everyone? Is that on your mind?
Absolutely. Yeah. Ealing is a really diverse borough and we really want to engage with the local community. So we've been working with lots of local groups and obviously trying to engage with the local schools. We've had some fantastic visits from local schools. Recently we had a primary school come and take over the front of house operations for the day, and we had some young year fives doing a fantastic job of guiding our visitors around. So very much working with local community groups, schools and educators to try and make sure that we can help them make best use of this wonderful facility in Ealing.
Fantastic. And so keep an eye on what's coming up. So the Hogarth exhibition is opening in the spring in March. That's great. My birthday munch. I shall come up. Keep an eye on the website.
Absolutely. Please do. Absolutely.
Right. Thanks to Claire Goff. And keep an eye out for events and exhibitions coming up at the Pitshanger Manor and Gallery in London's Ealing over the next year. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In just a minute, we'll be hearing from Chris Vaughan, director of experimental music festival Mode. In the past, he's brought the likes of Ryuichi Sakamoto on board for curatorial assistance. So to get in the mood, let's hear from Ryuichi from his 2005 album, 05. This is Amore. Ryuichi Sakamoto there. We'll be right back with Chris Vaughan after this.
Finally today, let's take a look at the border-hopping experimental music festival called Mode Exchange. Last year's inaugural festival colonised beautiful but abandoned spaces in London for performances curated by Laurel Halo that skirted the boundaries between music and sound art.
With next year's festival set to be curated by Ryoji Ikeda with iterations in Tokyo and London, I sat down with festival director Chris Vaughan to find out more about the festival's background, philosophy and, of course, future.
But what it actually is me trying to organise myself, I think, around lots of different events we've done over the years. So we've done events in Cairo, we've done events in Japan before, we've done events in London. Done lots of different live events, basically, whether music or your kind of art, sound art stuff as well. And it's me trying to focus our stuff within specific periods of the year.
You touched on it there, but it's obviously more than just gigs. You're not promoting gigs. It's a kind of interdisciplinary, experimental attitude to programming. How did you get there? What's the kind of philosophy behind what you do?
I'm not smart enough to have a philosophy as such, but I've fallen into this by working closely with artists, I'd say, is what got us there. So we've always avoided being what I would say is promoters. We've never really done shows in traditional venues. We've done a few things when they're huge shows, like the Sakamoto, when he curated the first year one, we did that at the Barbican. It makes sense to do something like that at the Barbican. But mainly we've been working outside of normal gig venues with institutions like the ICA or South London Gallery, or in completely derelict spaces. So the one we did last year in London was in a big six-storey derelict building in Soho, basically. So it's always come from us trying to find interesting ways of presenting, whether it's music or whether it's a different piece of... It depends how people project what they think their work is, but a performance of some sort in an interesting space in a way that audiences... Well, first and foremost, they a lot of the time don't get to go into those spaces. Regardless, they don't exist as spaces. We kind of create them. And secondly, I would say it's our relationship with the artists that because we've avoided being presented as promoters, or we've managed to kind of carve this niche out from being a standard promoter, we tend to work directly with artists rather than booking agents and then formulate ideas together. So the reason that Mode is curated by an artist has come from that. It's kind of leaning on our existing ties with pizza. We knew Sakamoto, we knew Laurel, and this is just leaning on those relationships. It actually takes a lot of the pressure off us to program stuff. And it also makes you realise how much artists know as well. The artists have programmed stuff that we wouldn't have done, but it's been some of the best stuff we've ever done. So
you mentioned Ryuichi Sakamoto there and Laurel Haler. Ryuichi Sakamoto has definitely been a guest on The Weekly a couple of times. And these are maybe the more high-profile artists that you're working with. Obviously, through them, you've kind of been put in touch with more obscure people who are maybe working at the margins of experimental music where it intersects with sound art, with sound design. What's your own engagement with that like? Are you voraciously consuming this sort of esoteric?
No. almost not in the slightest, but because it engulfs everything that I do around the music side of stuff or the performance side of stuff. Oh, I want to be careful of calling it music because it isn't just music. We're trying to bridge a kind of art world music gap that I think exists. I would say I'm constantly getting emails from new musicians, and particularly now we've got a label, new performers with ideas or commissions that they've got, or it'll be institutions all now, like the French Institute will approach us and say, look, we want you to apply for this fund. It needs to be an Anglo-Franco collaboration. Can you come up with an idea for it? So I almost don't have enough time, as you might not guess, but I don't have enough time to go to loads of different stuff. What I do get is invites to a few things. Like, I saw this phenomenal artist who was part of Mode this year. I kind of shoehorned him in. He's a Japanese artist. Highly recommend him. Called it Yuzuki Fujita. And I'd seen him out in Yokohama at something called TPAM. It's called Tokyo Performing Arts Meeting. It's a big kind of conference of producers and people who work within the arts come together every year. I got an invite through the Japan Foundation and saw this amazing artist there, so I shoehorned him in. He's a complete unknown. We're now going to be representing him in the UK and Europe and stuff. I would say that I probably don't watch anywhere near enough as what I should do.
You mentioned Japan there, and obviously you work very internationally, Egypt, France. What is it specifically about Japan? Because you've worked with Japanese audiences in the past, you put events on there, and you've brought Japanese performers here. Do you think, is this kind of liminal space, for want of a less pretentious term, where you're operating between art and between music, has it got a more mature audience in Japan?
Yeah, I would say actually when we started it that was probably the gap between the Japanese audience's verve for this and the British audiences wasn't that separate. But what's happened over the last 5 years is actually the British audiences, whether it's through saturation or lack of funds or promoters dropping out of the game or whatever it is, mostly money driven, I think. I would say that there is a big gap now. I mean, we have more interest from Japan than we do in the UK. It doesn't mean that we're hugely experienced with putting stuff on in Japan. We've almost been pulled there. As an example, which is kind of sad, as the state of events today, but we sold merch for the first time for Mode this year. And we sold 90% of it got flown to Japan. Do you know what I mean? Like, there just seems to be a drive in Japan to support the arts and a bit more left-field stuff. Here it's very difficult to sell into people the idea of doing shows with some of the people we do. They're not money-making things. Essentially, it's a loss-making. If they didn't have the support of institutions and stuff, these wouldn't draw big audiences and sell loads of tickets. The Sakamoto show would, but the really tiny ones. He loves this band called Kuken Gendai, and he was insisting that they were in the programme, but that was flying four people from Japan to London. No one had heard of them, so we were basically giving tickets away. They were amazing. But you can't, we seem to either operate with people who everyone knows or we operate with people who absolutely no one knows.
Which was clear kind of on the lineup for the Laurel Halo curated mode that took place back in 2019 now, we can say that, it's 2020. There were 10 hours of ambient programming on one day. I wondered, given that you started, you cut your teeth kind of at St. John's Sessions, which, for listeners who don't know, had a really broad range of performers from Nils Fram to Demdike Stare, from kind of both ends of the spectrum, and drew a really pleasantly mixed crowd, intergenerational as well. Have you noticed that there's been this sort of emergent appetite for music that maybe tips towards the atmospheric over the kind of traditional confines of genre?
I think it's definitely changed since we've been doing stuff. Since St. John's Sessions, Laurel wants to make... Laurel did an ambient set, and Laurel's interested in making ambient records. That's an example of how that... You would never think she might do that. Whether she does or not, it's entirely up to Laurel. But most artists now seem to be appreciating that sort of stuff. And I'm sure it's... You can philosophise why it is, but it almost is some sort of escapism. That kind of music is like the antidote, or the antithesis, rather, to techno clubbing in Berlin or whatever it might be. So I feel like there's a real drive for that. I feel like putting 10 ambient musicians on in one day was probably a mistake. I mean, everyone who came absolutely loved it. We had the drummer from, I can never say the name, it's like Sepultura, this Brazilian drummer called Igor Cavalero, and he was in the audience and was in, you know, messaging us on Instagram, and we're now doing a collaborative project with him and another artist. And I feel like the events carry enough integrity to carry them through, but they're certainly not, I would say, that the audiences for that, what was that, 500 people, do you know what I mean? We're not talking about 5,000 people turning up to these things. It's a niche. In Japan, I think that's a bit different. In Japan, there aren't venues big enough for what we could draw, I think, which is an interesting problem to have. But there's also, London is actually full, even though it doesn't seem, but of lots of empty spaces and weird kind of buildings in the very centre of town that you wouldn't know were there, that Russian oligarchs own and aren't selling or whatever it might be, and you're going to turn into a hotel. Japan's got a lot less of that. Japan's got a lot less of that. So we will have to change the way we work a bit out there, I think, and we'll learn a lot this year, I'm sure. But the idea is, the one in Japan is happening, it's the last week of the Paralympics in Japan. The idea is then to launch it annually after that. This has very much been funded by the Arts Council in Japan. And then we'll look to kind of build up a London and a Japan leg or Tokyo leg every single year.
So this is what's coming up in 2020. You mentioned those abandoned buildings, and this kind of intersection of urbanism and performance is super interesting. Is that something that you kind of arrived at organically? And how are you, you know, given that there's fewer of these kinds of spaces in Japan, how are you going to keep that strand of it alive over there over the next year?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer to that. I mean, we're looking at a space. So there's a big Banksy exhibition, which is going to Tokyo. I think it starts in March 2020, something like that. I think it's public knowledge, as far as I'm aware. If not, I've just made it. But there's a space called the Terada Warehouse, and it's a big industrial space that I'm sure will be much cleaner than the industrial spaces we've used. That's about as close as you get. Other than that, I think it will end up working with institutions. We may well put a show on in a standard venue as well if we have to. It's the summer in Japan as well, though, so I think we'll be doing some outside stuff, which allows us to kind of move away from that. London, this in 2020, will be interesting, because we've actually been requested by Ryoji Akita's going to be curating it, and he's requested that he specifically wants to do there's a really, really big show going to happen on the 17th of October at the Barbican that can't be announced, but that has to be at the Barbican because he's got a relationship with them. He wants to do some stuff with the Vinyl Factory because he has a relationship with them. So this is interesting. This is being formed a bit more by the venues and spaces are being determined more by the artists this time around. Why we started doing that in the first place is just my own personal interest in, I don't get to go in these buildings unless we put something on in them. And I've always had a bit of, you know, I see it a bit like building porn, these empty buildings that are just sitting there doing nothing. I'm intrigued by them anyway. You are limited because you'd have to work on a temporary event notice, which means you can only have 499 people. There are limitations to it that make it hard. But for whatever reason, I quite like doing it.
And I mean, it appeals. I think it all plays into this thing that you seem to have done very successfully, which is to be able to program
roster of musicians, as you say, they either operate in the very much in the public eye or completely beyond the fringes, and through that generate a kind of a brand loyalty, for want of a better word, on the part of audiences where people maybe have started to know that Mode will offer, we'll get tickets, we haven't heard of these people, but this is going to be an interesting night. Has that been kind of hard won?
I mean, I've lost money, lots of money. If that means it's hard won, I've lost a lot of money in the years, but I've also added, you know, I've been creating experiences for myself and for the people who are also involved with Mode. I mean, that's the stuff I really want to make happen, to be honest. It's quite easy. A lot of other people can put on the shows like Sakamoto. I mean, it's an absolute honour to be involved in it. But nobody else knew who... I mean, we use Ziku Fujita. I come back to the guy we brought over this year, who I was kind of elbowing Laurel to get him in. I was like, he's amazing, honestly. But he had never even left Japan. So the idea of creating this, almost for my own personal story, as it is for the audiences, it's like, it's so nice to have seen that in Japan and bring that over, and no one knows who it is, and he's going to be... Because I'm fully aware that I think in 20 years' time, he'll be a name. So I don't know whether it's hard work. I'm creating the hard work for myself as opposed to finding myself in a challenging position I didn't want. All of this has basically been unplanned in the best possible way, but to be difficult.
So you did mention Japan. When is this festival going to be taking place?
August the 28th to September the 6th, and you have heard this here first. No one knows that yet. And we've only just had confirmation because we were going back and forth with the Olympic funding spaces. So 28th of August to the 6th of September in Japan, or Tokyo rather, and then the London leg is a month later, which looks more than likely that it's going to start with a big show at the Barbican, which is one of the most outrageous collaborations that we could have... I mean, I haven't come up with it, Ikeda has, but something very weird that's going to be at the Barbican that day that no one will expect, but I'm sure will be good fun.
Sounds great. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you to Chris Vaughan, and stay on top of Mode's developments on social media and online. You are with the Monocle Weekly.
What a lot of exciting stuff to look out for in 2020, Rob.
That's good stuff. It's nice to have all these kind of new voices. A celebration of Fitzcarraldo, which anyone that works vaguely in publishing, anyone that's read the culture pages of Monocle and all the rest of it will have seen. We've reviewed quite a lot of their books. But it's nice to get the sort of history from the man himself, the horse's mouth.
Big time.
He's a cool guy. And I love the idea that we're not going to do something fancy. It's going to be sort of the idea of being iconic when you're yet to publish a book is quite it seems obvious now, but that was quite a shot in the dark, I'd have thought, for Mr. Tistar back in the day.
Indeed. And he also, you know, had this good thing going on. He co-founded White Review, which, as you know, is one of the leading literary journals, certainly here in the UK. And so he was saying that his English... fiction often will just he'll draw from the pool of winners of various prizes, people who are published in the pages of the White Review, which is a really nice relationship. Elsewhere I've read that he's very keen to support authors, you know, regardless of how their first book lands, which, unlike big corporate publishers, which you might expect to drop someone if they don't suddenly make £1 million, whatever, he knows that an author matures, that their audience grows over time, over 2 or 3 or 4 books. He's looking to kind of go with them for the long term.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. He feels like a benevolent label boss in the sort of like big-hearted days of the 1970s music industry.
Exactly. And as you heard, that's exactly how he described it himself. I think Mode Exchange is something that you want to keep very squarely...
I'm going to get down and dirty. I can get down and dirty in both Tokyo and London. I can take him around, so I can make a... I can do an outside broadcast for you, or if you so desire.
I think I'd like that. Laurel Halo did the last one, and it's, you know, there's this amazing mix. On the one hand, quite big names, Laurel Halo, Sakamoto, they've done a lot with. Then on
Can't
the other,
be bad.
Totally unknown, like mad people from rural Japan who are like it's doing great wild stuff.
Yeah.
Being brought over, it's the only time you'll ever see them, let alone hear of them, following of 30 people somewhere. It just so happens that one of those people is Sakamoto, and boom. You
know? Yeah, it's good
so
stuff.
It's really good stuff. Let's say bye and thanks.
Yeah, let's do it. That was all for edition 548 of the Monocle Weekly.
I produced today's show, and our studio manager was May Lee Evans.
And the Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
Happy New Year.
And bye.